is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. Each week we explore the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. In today's episode we have a guest to discuss consensual non-monogamy. Here's our hosts Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max. Hey, Beast, how you doing tonight?
I'm good, Woody, and you're looking well.
Well, thank you, sir. You know, we have a beautiful woman in our studio tonight.
I know, she's looking better than both of us.
I'd like to introduce our guest. That is Shiva's Vessel.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great, thank you.
I understand you've done a lot of psychosocial research.
Correct.
Tonight's topic is consensual non-monogamy. How's that work?
Well, consensual non-monogamy encompasses a lot of things that we talk about every day. Polyamory, dating in some cases, people who are monogamish, kind of monogamous, swingers, open marriage, people who have religious practices, and the list is long. We'll talk more about the other things too, but one of the things that is the defining element of consensual non-monogamy is that two or more people have agreed upon a way to have a relationship that is usually non-traditional. It may involve marriage. It may involve relationships without sex, relationships with sex, but there's all different kinds.
So what sets us apart from standard issue dating?
It doesn't. It can be one form of consensual non-monogamy, especially if you're a serial dater, if you date more than one person and everybody knows. If everybody in the relationship knows, then it can be meeting the guidelines of consensual non-monogamy.
I think society norms lay out a monogamy as the standard.
Yes. Now, they lay that out as the standard now, but it hasn't always been the standard.
How's that work?
Well, in the last couple of centuries, we've seen monogamy as the standard. But in centuries past, people would have their marriages, their mistresses, their lovers, multiple other people that lived in their household that may or may not be involved in some sort of relationship, and they all acted cooperatively. That was the practice often.
I've noticed that even now in Europe, that is still the practice in some areas.
The European lifestyle is more accepting of those relationships in public. I think here we don't talk about them as much in public, but I think there may be more of that going on in our culture than you would think.
Interesting.
Is this based on, you think, the puritanical founding of this country?
I would say definitely. I think religious practices form taboos out of some of the things that we would pursue. They form barriers to creating these relationships when the religious rules are a man and a woman get married, they have children, and so on and so forth, but one in one. The traditional monogamous marriage is actually on the decline. The Pew Foundation has determined that we are straying away from marriage very quickly in this country. The numbers are declining every year.
Toward what? Just living together or living together in a monogamy or a poly relationship?
They don't go so far as to define it that way. They look at people that are cohabiting without marriage or people that are living in some other relationship configuration rather than standard marriage, and they lump it together.
Is this based, you think, any part of this based on the becoming more wise to the merits of marriage in the traditional sense?
I think that divorce has had an extreme effect on our culture as far as children seeing other kinds of relationships other than the traditional monogamous relationship. In the past, that hasn't been the case. They've seen the traditional marriage as the standard. But what's happened in the last several decades is that people have seen their spouses split. Even much older people that you would usually expect to stay in a relationship, I'm talking 70, 80, 90 years old, I'm seeing them divorcing now and coming into the community to be single, which is usually in the past what would happen is your spouse would die and you would become single. But now we're seeing people that have just been married long enough, they don't want to do it anymore, and so they split. And those kind of changes with divorce being more acceptable, people seeing models for relationships other than marriage or people seeing failed marriages has created a culture that's more open to other possibilities.
That's really throwing a wrinkle in the, quote, traditional marriage and family.
Absolutely. And when you see people that are comfortable splitting, staying together for the children is no longer the only option. So you see people going into alternative parenting situations, group families with multiple women and multiple children with no males in the house, or males and females in the house with groups of children that are not related. You see people living together that are not sexually involved, like roommate situations, that then become different over time because they build bonds. So I think the fluidity of our current relationship picture is really interesting because we're just seeing things that we haven't seen before.
So it's a brave new world right now.
In my opinion, yes. And it's also a world that we're starting to talk about. We haven't talked about this before. So in the last 10 years, the amount of research that's being done about consensual non-monogamy has just exploded. There's so much work being done, so much research, so many books being written, so many researchers that are out in the wide world with this as a somewhat taboo topic in the past that are now putting these things out there as research possibilities.
And entertainment.
Yes. Absolutely. And if you look on the major television channels, there are shows all over the place that embrace this concept. And once things get into the popular culture, acceptance really goes up.
In the traditional relationships that I was referring to, if somebody strayed outside the relationship, it was often called cheating. This is very different than that.
Correct. Cheating is not consensually non-monogamous. Cheating is non-consensual. So one party may know nothing about the relationship that's going on. It's behind closed doors. It's hidden. And if something's hidden from one of the parties, it by definition is not consensual. That's probably the most common way that we've seen in the past multiple relationships play out within a monogamous culture. So in that case, you might have sites like Ashley Madison and different places that promote being able to hide and play, or dating sites where people masquerade as single when they're not, and people were able to hook up and find partners that way. And in some cases, they would find partners and then stay with those partners for many years. I'm familiar with a few people who have been partners in those kind of scenarios for multiple decades. They've developed a relationship that's akin to marriage with this partner, but they're still cheating.
Long-term cheating.
Long-term cheating. It's actually more common than you might think. So that's the old case of the mistress, I guess you could say.
But wasn't it true that for in various periods in our time that having the mistress was an accepted part, even though it wasn't socially acceptable, the wife knew that the mistress existed, even if it wasn't talked about?
Or suspected that there was another partner but didn't choose to explore it. For all kinds of reasons, security would be challenged in some cases if you did that. And if you have, you're threatened by a loss of your security to know something for a fact, you may choose not to know it for a fact.
And now we see an increase in women able to take care of themselves and financially, emotionally, and so forth. So do you think that's a factor?
I think so. I do think so. Actually, one of the big trends that's happening now is so many more people are living alone.
This is true, and they're still looking for companionship, even though they don't want a traditionally committed relationship.
And it goes back to when we were young, when we would date numerous people, and it's starting to be fashionable for older people to do that.
We went through a stage where people wanted to be monogamous within dating relationships when they were young, and it was frowned on to date multiple people. So we had serial monogamy as a way that people got variety in their lives and found experience in relationships. But now I think you're seeing some trends to people balancing multiple relationships when they date. And that does provide a little bit more of a variety, maybe an attraction to continue that later.
Well, I'm finding with the teenagers I come into contact with through my various friends that they are much more open to the idea of a social dating situation instead of the committed dating that we all grew up with.
And we can't really, even now, define every kind of relationship that exists within a consensual non-monogamy definition, because I sat down and came up with 20 different relationship configurations just off the top of my head that ranged everywhere from dating to polykink families and harems, which do exist. Those kind of situations do exist, and what people call polyfuckery, which is just having a stable of people in your life that you move between and spend time with different people. It's still a form of consensual non-monogamy as long as everyone knows what's going on.
If everybody knows what the rules are.
Right.
And then everybody can play.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And this goes back to a topic we've had before, communication.
Communication is everything with this. It won't work if you can't communicate.
How many people practice this form of CNM?
It is so nebulous in many ways because you have to figure out what you're going to include in that pool. What relationships are you going to consider, and are you going to look at it in terms of just at any given time or across the course of a lifetime? But the numbers that I've seen range anywhere from 9% of the population all the way to 28%. And that I don't think they're quite that high, but I would say the 9 to 15% range is probably acceptable when you consider all the different relationship statuses that we're looking at.
Within the consensual side.
Right.
If you take the non-consensual side, it goes way over 60.
Way up.
Yes, I saw the percentages of men that have affairs and women, and they're both well over 50% of the population.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, thing that I find really interesting is if you break this down between men and women, as they have with the divorce statistics, and they've looked at with cheating and affairs in general, you tend to see a good even split between men and women with some concentrations in different groupings. Like in the polykink community, you may see more representation of one sex, and in, call it vanilla poly, that's probably not very nice, but I mean, people that aren't kinky, don't have any unusual practice, they're just relationship driven within this, you might see more concentration, say, for instance, of women. But then if you look at some of the more hardcore areas, you're going to find more of a concentration of men, most likely. But it does break down pretty evenly between the sexes across the boards.
I imagine it would also be different in the gay community, to where the men are going to have one set of rules of engagement and the women are going to have something different.
I would say so. I look at rules a lot from the perspective of how do you make rules work so the relationships work. But I don't find that there are blanket rules within communities. They tend to be very individualized, and they tend to be survival rules. People define the barriers and boundaries, and that becomes the definition for them, and that's where the rules work. And rules tend to be very, in certain communities, you do see more of rule-driven behavior. Like the swing community is very rule-driven. There are rules for everything, and if you break the rules in the swing community, there may be serious problems within the relationship. If you're not allowed to kiss another person and you forget and you kiss another person, you can be in a lot of trouble because certain things are considered intimate only for the relationship of the primary people.
Sex is just sex.
True, but kissing is different. At least in some communities.
It certainly is. When we first started, we were talking about that this could go back several hundred years. So how new is this thing that we're calling CNM right now?
I think the definition of it that way, as opposed to just calling everything polyamory, which was sort of the way things were for the last about two or three decades.
Kind of a catch-all?
Two decades. When the terms were coined, it was catch-all. And now I think the trend toward using this consensual non-monogamy and then being more specific about what you're looking at is probably a better way of doing it.
One thing I'd like to clarify a little bit on that is polyamory is essentially the love of many. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about love in this case. We're talking about consensual non-monogamy. So we're just opening up relationships, not necessarily loving relationships, but relationship with multiple people.
Correct. Some of the relationships can be quite casual and serve the purpose and still be defined that way. But, you know, we have certain kinds of relationships in there that pose a lot more challenges, and I think we'll talk more about those as we go on. But the difficulty has to be you have to look at the component of the relationship and not try to slap a label on it right away. because you may look at a relationship and it looks on the outside to be a certain kind of way, and yet the dynamic is not that. Often in the poly kink community, well, I'll give you a better example. I was talking to somebody this week who was here from out of town, and they said, well, there's not much of a poly community in this city. Talking to him more, I said, well, have you considered the poly kink community? And he said, well, no, they're not poly. Well, they are poly. Many of them are poly, and poly in a very traditional way. But in his definition, they were not. And so he'd stuck a label on it, and then everything outside that label did not count.
But aren't we label-driven as a society as a whole? We want to box everything up in a nice, neat package. And these relationships don't usually fit in a box.
They don't, and it's really hard to refrain from labeling things. In fact, that's part of the communication issue that we deal with as we develop in these roles, is trying to learn how to talk to each other and not immediately stick a label. You're so this, you're so that, this is so bad, or this is so good, or you're always this way, or I don't get this. Because if you start talking that way with your partner, you close everything down. Partners.
And that brings up, these relationships can be quite extended sometimes, can't they?
They can be very extended, and they can also be tiered. We have people don't like to talk about, and frequently will try to steer away from talking about tiered relationships where you have primary people in your life and you have secondary people in your life. I talk about primary versus secondary people because not everybody has one primary person. There may be a primary or primary group or people that you are mostly involved with, or even if they're not labeled that way. But they're still the people that you give your time to the most. They're still the people that you consider first when you're making decisions. And then there may be other people beyond that circle that are part of your life that you interact with. And it gets really complicated really fast in those situations when you add more and more people. The more people you add, and every time you add somebody new, the dynamics of the whole situation change.
We're moving on. What are some of the most common challenges for these relationships and people in them?
Those skew a couple of different directions. One of the areas that we deal with all the time are just practical considerations, and that includes things like, where do people live? How many people live together? What are the other things that are expected of you in the household? That's if you have a shared living arrangement. If you don't have a shared living arrangement, then how many houses are involved? How many days of the week can you be together among all the different? How many places do you have to go to be with everybody? How many days are off limit? Because you have other responsibilities. And so, you know, those practical considerations. How much money do you have to be able to support this arrangement? Because some of these arrangements can be really complicated and expensive. But there are other more nebulous qualities like fear of the people that are participating. Fear is one of the biggest destructive elements within this type of relationship formation, because we have fear of somebody in the relationship meeting Mr. or Ms. Perfect, the person that's going to take them away and destroy everything that is in the status quo. That's one of the biggest fears people have. They're afraid that they will lose their partner.
That also goes with hidden agendas then.
Yes. And usually that means you haven't talked enough and there's more talking that needs to happen. Or you haven't established enough between you and your partner that you already have as far as the importance of the other person to you. Because once I think that's established for a lot of people, they do better. Whenever there are areas of fear and doubt, you're going to have problems, usually.
Well, this is a matter of trust in many cases, isn't it? The amount of communication you've put into it to establish the trust base.
Right. Fear of the unknown. I mean, people are afraid of the unknown. They don't know how their life will change as new things are introduced. Not necessarily new people, but new things associated with the new people, or new protocols, or new routines. They also have many times expressed fear of abandonment and loss of what they have now or of the situation that they have established. People fear replacement. They don't want to be replaced in the eyes of their beloved. So that becomes an issue that usually has to be worked through. Fear of being judged less than the other person, the person they should be, the person who they have promised to be. We make a lot of commitments as we go into relationships, and we're held to those standards sometime beyond when the point that you can actually do that any longer. If you have had a lot of changes in your life, if you're 10 years older than you were when you made those commitments and promises, your ability to maintain that standard may have changed as well.
Well, many relationships become static and don't evolve as the people involved do evolve.
Very true. People fear losing their place in line. It's funny, but losing, if they're in a tiered relationship where there are people that are, their perceived higher status may not actually be a higher status, but if they perceive that something's going to happen and they're going to lose their spot in line, they can be very challenged by that. One thing that I talk about a lot is people fear losing the quantity of whatever it is that they're getting now, that they're going to lose that.
Well, and resources are viewed as finite, and wonder if those resources are, whether it be time or love. And love is an infinite concept, but time is a finite concept.
And that's very true. What I do tell people is that love is infinite, but time is not. And that's probably one of the biggest fears that we deal with, is that I'm going to lose the time I have with you. I'm going to lose the time that you invest in the relationship with me. And that term actually has a name. It's called time envy, where you are covetous of the time that someone else is getting. And it may be because at this moment in time, there are things going on with another partner that pull them away, and there may be completely unavoidable. However, they may in fact be real losses that somebody's experiencing, and it becomes a point of negotiation to find a way to balance things out so everyone who's involved feels like they're getting enough.
I have heard a saying that the poly call is, let's check our calendars.
And I find myself doing that multiple times a day, especially when you're dealing with new people who you don't know their schedules yet. You don't know what their life is like. So anytime you introduce somebody new, everyone has to coordinate. Becomes really important. The other thing that's associated with these challenges, and it's a big one, is what's called new relationship energy. Anytime you bring somebody new into the picture, there is usually a honeymoon period, and that honeymoon period can be frightening for the established relationships because there really is a component of lust or infatuation going on where the focus is very much on getting to know this new person and see how they fit in, and they may or may not be involved with the other people in the established relationship. So it could be that a lot of that's going on out of the sight of the other participants. We don't, as poly people, always all interact together. Very rarely, in fact, is every single relationship within a poly group present and working or doing things together at the same time. And so anything that's happening outside of the purview of the rest of the group is a big unknown, and it can pose challenges for them. And that's where a lot of these feelings of jealousy that people express come from. And they may not, in fact, be experiencing jealousy. They may be experiencing fear and time envy.
Fear of the unknown is the hardest thing for the human being to deal with. And so the mind will run wild trying to invent things to fit in that are not necessarily positive.
And we really can't read someone else's mind, so we don't know what they're really thinking. We just try to fill it up with what we think they might be thinking. A friend of mine calls that being a mind reader. You know, we're not a mind reader, and so we have to really pull that in and not do that. It's very destructive to do that, and it generates more fear. It snowballs from that. NRE is fun and it's scary, it's time limited, and it can be destructive for the affected parties if it's not addressed, and it needs to be handled with sensitivity. But it's a real experience for everybody. If you're not going into a relationship and experiencing that, you're probably not involved with somebody that you're getting what you need from, because I know very few cases where there's none of that.
So it's a real heady thing. It's part of the endorphin high that we've talked about in previous episodes.
It sure is. And it also usually is in the kinky community. It may be involved with new kinds of play, different configurations or different scenes, different tools, different people. And that also increases the potential risk for that.
Is there such a thing as scene envy or scene jealousy?
Oh, yeah. It's a component of the same thing. And that's related to the concept of they're getting the play that I'm not getting. I should be the one receiving that. I should be the one in that scene right now, and I'm not. And if that can be a point where you need to go back to the drawing board with your partner and the partner that's feeling that way and find ways that you all can satisfy that need, either to find other play partners for them or to find time to play with them or maybe ways to play together or to involve them in some way with the scene, even if it's not an active participant, but they might be involved in some component on it so they can take some ownership of it.
In the past, we've talked about a scene questionnaire, which we have posted on our website in the Tools tab. And sometimes renegotiating a scene profile with a partner that you've had for years because of changes, and especially if play has happened between two people in the relationship that is outside of the box of the person that is feeling jealous. Maybe a renegotiation, maybe open up things that were taboo in the past and allow exploration into new areas, which will then freshen the NRE in an old relationship.
I think that's some of the static that you were talking about that happens with an existing relationship. For instance, not going through and talking about new fetishes and interests that you may have developed, or not pursued something because at the time it wasn't something that everybody mutually agreed on. Now it's more interesting. And so that is very true, very true. I recently went through that and found I had a whole lot of things that I wasn't listing and talking about that were of interest to me. And just listing them made me excited again. So
I know every time I read through the scene questionnaire, there's things that it reminds me of that I haven't done in 10 years or more. And I went, okay, need to discuss that with my partners.
Are jealousy and envy the same thing?
No, they're not. Jealousy comes with expectations. So we have certain expectations of our significant others in our life. And we have expectations of how they're going to behave or be in certain situations. Jealousy is often generated when they begin to do something we don't expect or behave in a way we aren't anticipating. And then we have feelings that rise because of that, that are usually not positive, that have to do with. And I really think the word malicious is not too strong in this case. Malicious feelings about the situation that they're observing or that they're involved in that revolve around fear. Fear of loss, fear of abandonment. And jealousy is more directed toward the outside person. Usually it's not focused on your significant other, but it's usually focused on another outside entity. So it would be another woman, another man, a child who's taking all of their time, a boss that is keeping them on the job too long. Envy is different than that. Envy is more related to covetousness. You're just not upset and fearful. You want that thing, or you want what that other person has. So it's a bit more directed toward a circumstance or something surrounding the situation that you're encountering. They are easy to confuse, very easy to confuse, because in every situation, they apply a little differently. There's a website that's very good, especially for poly people, that talks a lot about these issues, and it addresses some of them very specifically. The website is morethan2.com. And they have practical ideas and suggestions for managing lots of things, including time management skills and definitions of envy and jealousy. So that would be a really good source to quickly look at it, because they use some relationship comparisons that will delineate that for you, help you understand in practical consideration.
You can find that site on our Hot Links page.
Time envy. I've heard the term batted around, used. And we just talked about envy and jealousy. So how does time envy fit?
Time envy is probably the biggest area that we deal with when we have multiple people involved, because, as I said, relationships and love can be unlimited. However, time is not. We all work. We all have obligations outside of our relationships that take us away a good part of every day. And if you were to draw a clock, you would be able to carve out the time you spend every day at your job, the time you have to sleep, and when you put in things like eating, dressing, grooming, things you have to do, and then look at what you have left, it's very small for most people. If you have one person in a relationship with you, and you're in a monogamous relationship, that can be challenging. When you add two or more additional people to that situation, it can become like a three-ring circus. And for some people, it's not manageable because you begin to subdivide the time, and there is not enough time to give anybody a fair shot at having a relationship. But it doesn't mean that we don't want to. So we have to keep going back and looking at our time and our obligations to find ways to make it work if we want to have these consensually non-monogamous relationships.
How do consensual non-monogamous relationships weather all these challenges?
Well, some don't. Some are short-term and they don't make it. But I've seen a fair number recently that have lasted a long time. And the things that I've found that work, and talking to the people that are in these relationships, probably number one is learn to breathe. You have to learn to breathe. And the second is you need to learn to press your lips together and squeeze them tightly until the urge to speak is past sometime. Because there are times in these situations where things are going to be said that if we remember them for very long, they'll be hurtful. So learning to be a little bit tougher, have a little thicker skin sometimes is a good thing. But on the other hand, being sensitive to the needs of your partners and to look at the big picture, including all the people in your relationship constellation. You may have a relationship with two people, but they also may have relationships with other people, and all of those people can be affected by everything you do. So it becomes a bit sometimes complicated. You have to really open your mind up to think about what the impact of your decision to take a vacation next week for a week and a half when other people are involved might affect all those people in the relationship. But it's important and something that will help improve the quality of the relationship.
Sometimes we have to take the selfish out of it and put a little empathetic in it.
Yes. We also have to be really sensitive to the risks to all the participants. We make decisions that they may affect us, but they may create harm or risk to other people. And that may include things like our decisions for where to live, but it might also include things about how we play, how we deal with our health, how we deal with the physical bonding between partners, how many people we're bonded together with. All those things are factors that we have to think about. And it requires thinking on a broader scale than we typically do.
And again, communication, communication, communication.
I like to think of any kind of consensually non-monogamous situation as one that requires some scripting going in. At least even in a casual situation, there has to be discussion, and things like boundaries need to be established. You need to know where your boundaries are. You need to know where your partner's boundaries are. We need to know what their fears are. What if their big fear is a certain thing, you don't want to bring that certain thing into that situation without a lot of discussion. And that certain thing could be anything. It doesn't have to be a person. It could be a dynamic, or it could be a place. All kinds of things like that factor in, and it just becomes very much more complicated in these situations.
So self-awareness is a very important quality for all of the participants in these relationships.
Yes. One of the things we need to do is we always need to remember that our force of will may be very powerful. And in fact, in the poly kink community, force of will with dominant men or women can be a real factor that differs from other kinds of consensually non-monogamous situations, because you may not have that same power dynamic going on in other relationships. So even though we can get someone to agree to what we want, it still may not be the right thing. So that negotiation and sensitivity, open communication, lots of discussion, lots of open, not defensive communication is going to be extremely valuable. And it will also probably save relationships when they get in trouble.
And it will keep relationships from leaving a sour taste in the future if they don't last.
Force of will is an interesting combination of words there. I've seen in the past where somebody has yielded to a agreement that seemed right on the surface, but there was wavering doubts down deep, and those will only fester and come up to the surface at a later time. It really has to be clarified as to what the will is and what the agreement. in order for it to be consensual, we really have to be in agreement as to what is on the table.
I really agree with that statement, because it's a bit difficult when you have somebody that is submissive dealing with a dominant person to say no sometime. And they also typically want to please the person that they're serving or providing services for. And so the dominant person sometimes may have to take a slightly different approach with the person they're dealing with in a power dynamic in order to really get everything on the table, because the person that's submissive may just have a very hard time saying, I really am not comfortable with this situation, or I really would like it if you didn't spend the night away. If you're 24/7 with someone and they begin spending the night away from you, that may be a very challenging situation that they're not comfortable speaking up about. But it creates this underlying dissatisfaction that will eventually surface. And one of the things that I tell people is, when you're paying attention to the big picture, you need to make sure that you're also paying attention to the little things. Because there are ways that we know our partners, and they may not say the words, but they may show you in other ways what their concerns are. And it makes you have to be looking for the signs and wonders in the situation and not maybe listening for the words, because the words may not come out. I used to call it also, though, on the other side of it, if you want to go, you got to ask. The submissive person in a situation, or the person who's less dominant, needs to learn to step up, pull up their belt, and say what's on their mind. It's very difficult, and sometimes they may not be able to say it. They may have to write it or find another way to convey it. But if it's not conveyed, their partner will not know.
We'll go back to the beast words, communication.
Now, I see a word that I cannot pronounce frequently. Compersion. That is one that every poly book I have read, it's at least a chapter. Sometimes it's a section. What is it?
Compersion is finding joy in the joy of your partner. So you find joy because of what your partner is experiencing and the joy that they're receiving. And so, for instance, it might be that your partner has a new play partner, and maybe it's a bit more than casual. They've developed a good relationship, a really nice friendship, maybe even some intimacy and affection for each other. And you find a way to grow enough to be happy and joyful that that's occurred, and actually feel it inside when you're with that person. And it's difficult when you haven't practiced it. It's difficult when you follow the path that we are taught, usually, traditionally, is to fear and feel hostility towards somebody who's viewed as an interloper in our relationships. When you can move past that and see that there's room for another person, and that there actually may be a relationship there for all parties, not just for the two people playing together, then you have approached compersion. I have done a lot of research on that, and it's a difficult feeling for people to maintain, and it has to be cultivated. It's not a natural feeling for most people, but I do think it's real, but you have to cultivate it. And it means having to stop your fear and live with your fear for a moment, and then try to think about whether your fear is justified, and then find ways to release it and look at the positive aspects of the situation.
This is the polar opposite of jealousy.
Very much so. It's so foreign to people. And yet it's so important if you're going to have these multiple relationship dynamics, because the ideal situation would be that everybody would have positive feelings toward each other, that even though there may be bumps in the road sometime, that everybody would find ways, because they like and engage the other people with positive feelings, that they can move over and past those things, and they can wash over them and move on. It's maybe not always practical, but it's that ideal.
I think once you achieve compersion, it also has to be fed.
And I found one of the best ways to feed it is when two or more people are talking and they begin to recognize that those feelings are occurring. They need to be rewarded, acknowledged, supported. And sometime you need to stop everything and say something great, like, this is fantastic, and find a way to reward the person who's demonstrating that, because that reward is going to make them feel more comfortable in the future with that feeling.
So basically, reward positive behavior.
Yes.
Now, I see terms sometimes out there, such as open marriage. Mm-hmm. Is that poly?
Yes, that is a form of poly. As long as both parties know the marriage is open. You'd be amazed the number of people who don't know they're in an open marriage.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we go back to the cheating. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Also, open marriage doesn't necessarily have to have an amorous side to it.
Correct. Now, some people who are in an open marriage understand the rules, and yet the rules are not being practiced as they agreed. So a spouse may think that it's okay for my partner to date. I don't want them to fall in love. I don't want them to make another person primary in their life. And then a form of cheating can occur because the relationship changes without both parties being aware and agreeing to it.
But on the same token, maybe what you just said is that one party feels that it shouldn't get to that, feels that it shouldn't go that far, and maybe it was never communicated clearly.
And that's a good example for why the rules need to be continually renegotiated and reviewed. And I say rules, and that's actually too static a word because we don't have written rules. Some people have written contracts, but most people don't have the rules written. They have them informally agreed to. And it never hurts to go back over those from time to time and talk about them and have a touching base conversation to see if everyone is still on the same page. And if there are multiple people involved, it's always good to be able to know you can go and ask questions and talk about it, although you may not necessarily be able to go and ask and interrogate the other person about their other relationships. There should be some openness to discussion if there are feelings of concern.
What is a poly-mono relationship?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. And, you know, a lot of times you see that in open marriage situations. And often they occur because the fates have not been kind to one of the people in the relationship. So they may have made a decision to open the relationship up. And then for whatever reason, one partner has more positive opportunities to explore. They have more chances to play. They have more dates. And the other one, for whatever reason, does not. And when that happens, it can be extremely uncomfortable. It can create a polymono situation even if you don't want it to. One person is just actively not playing. Or, two people start out to be in a poly relationship, but as they get out and get into the community and they're actually doing it, it becomes uncomfortable for one of them. You see this a lot in the swing community. You see people who go out and they start playing and they're all very active, and then all of a sudden one or the other party starts to feel uncomfortable with a relationship and they start to pull away or want to renegotiate. This often leads to cheating because with one partner who's happy and enjoying the situation and the other one who's not, it could create enough tension that someone would actually continue and hide it. And so poly-mono situations often occur when you have an imbalance within the relationship, and it's really difficult to negotiate your way out of that.
I consider myself in a poly-mono relationship with my longest relationship. She has the option of being poly, but she's not chosen to exercise that in the 12 years we've been together. Similarly, the other two relationships are not exercising their options to have additional partners. So it's interesting when you become the sole support structure for three other people.
And exhausting, too.
No, tell me. Tell me.
Emotional support structure.
Emotional support structure.
I've been in a situation where I was essentially in a monopoly situation for a while. And it was very difficult and actually led to us restructuring things because it just couldn't work the way it was. And in the restructure, there was a lot of emotion. And there was a lot of frustration on the part of one partner and a lot of anger because of it. But I wasn't willing to give up everything that I had attained, and he wasn't willing to let things stand as they were. Over time, those imbalances were removed, and we're still quite close. But it's extremely difficult to negotiate your way out of that situation. And sometime you have to make a decision. Am I going to continue in this situation? Some people have pulled in and just gone back to monogamous situations because they could not balance the emotions, balance the relationships, balance the time. It needs to be a consciously made decision.
There's an interesting word that keeps coming up, polyfuckery. What is that?
I hear it often in a very negative context, and it really is used often for the situation where somebody's just out to just have as many partners as they can. You also hear it used in the term of a harem, and it can work on both sides. Having multiple partners, and there may be some long-term partners, or just I call it the changing cast of characters. Lots of short-term relationships, or even some longer-term relationships, but they're not really, usually when I hear that term, it is not surrounding emotional relationships, or at least not long-term committed relationships. It tends to be more sexual in orientation. Nothing wrong with it. It's all according to the rules of the people that are playing. Whatever they agree to, as long as everybody agrees to it, there's nothing wrong with it.
But I do hear it used as in the derogatory sense, much much more often. But it's got that word "fuck" in it, and that's derogatory in our society as a whole.
Well, I guess so. I don't think it's a bad word.
I don't think it's a bad word. The society seems to think it is.
You know, I think that a lot of people apply polyfuckery to the swing community. And yet, many of the people that swing that I know are very, very loving and caring toward each other in groups and with their friends. They tend to have really strong fidelity bonds with their close friends. And many actually interact a lot together in groups. But it is used a lot as a derogatory term and usually used to punish somebody. So it's a punishing word.
Maybe that's the reason I hear it so often.
There are some points that I just want to hit for y'all about some things that help make relationships successful when you have multiple people involved. We talked a little about not being coercive and trying to predefine the shape of the relationship. But it's important when you're dealing with multiple people that try not to be a scorekeeper. It's really hard, especially with one person in the dynamic having more action, if you would say, or more relationship have the other partners keeping score about that. It puts pressure on everybody involved. And it's important to be sensitive to your partner's partners. So make sure you're not trying to drive everything within your relationships by what your needs are, but try to look out and extend that to the other people in the constellation. This is very important. Being poly, opening some of these consensually non-monogamous relationship situations is not going to improve bad relationships. So if you already are in a bad relationship situation, bringing more people in is not going to make it better. Those relationship problems need to be dealt with on their own beforehand. And often if you can deal with those situations prior to trying to open up a relationship or going into a poly or a non-monogamous situation, you're going to have a better outcome. And, you know, always just try to observe decorum and privacy with your partners. There are serious consequences for a lot of people if they maintain non-conforming relationships. So if your partner doesn't want to be out as poly in the community, that needs to be respected. There's nothing more disturbing than having people that you work with find out things about your lifestyle that you're not ready to provide. And that may involve limiting information that you provide in the public settings like, oh, I don't know, Facebook and other places like that. Or what you tell people that are in your relationship constellation and friendships. So respecting everybody in the group, being sensitive to everyone's feelings, sometimes fighting it out if you have to, and trying to be open with your communication is going to be helpful in keeping the relationship stable.
Fantastic. A lot of great information there.
Yes, definitely. Thank you, Shiva Vissel.
You're welcome.
Cassie has a question that she wants to read that came in through our Bashful link. That is our completely private, anonymous link on the website that if you want to submit a question, don't want anybody to know who's sending it, just click on the Bashful tab, type in the question you want, and hit send. And then one of our worthy assistants, either Max or Cassie, will read it. So here we go.
I am of a poly mindset, but my fiancé is not. I am capable of loving and to love more than one person at a time. We have a monogamous relationship, but I feel like I'm missing something or not being true to myself. He's been very understanding of how I feel. and there hasn't been any fighting over it. I guess I am asking for advice on how other couples handle a situation where one is poly and the other is not.
Ms. Shiva's Vessel, how does that play into what we just talked about?
Well, it sounds like they're talking to each other, and that's important. They're talking about the nature of things, but it may be that she needs to talk more about what her needs are, what her desires are, and then talk about what the impact of will be on him as a spouse, because if she chooses to act on them, unless they've agreed to that, it could be painful for him and for her. She talked about fiancé. I think one thing that just jumps out to me is that this is something that needs to be resolved before they move to the next stage, because this is very fundamental to a relationship about whether how you see yourself, how you see your power dynamic, your relationship dynamic. And if one is going in so very different, you better be sure that they're going to be okay if you decide to act on it at some point, or you better be okay with not acting on it. And that would need to be determined on the front end. I think this is a really good case for a lot of front-end loading conversation. You may find going into it that they're quite fine with it as long as you don't act on it, but then that's no fun if you feel really or truly poly.
Well, isn't it true that you should never go into marriage expecting to change your partner?
Absolutely. Change doesn't typically happen after the fact. It doesn't really happen too much before. If you're trying to be true to your nature, you wouldn't want to be married to somebody who didn't share your common your values and goals. And I think this fits with common values and goals. It's pretty fundamental.
And there's also the matter that what's good for the girlfriend may not be good for the wife.
Absolutely. It's funny how the preconceived notions about marriages and traditional monogamy often don't surface until you actually are in that situation, no matter what you've said, no matter what your views have been. When you actually get into that situation, you may have very different feelings.
Or your partner may have very different feelings.
Very true.
It's that time, Woody.
I think we've distracted our audience for long enough. Let's let them get back to what they do.
And do it so well and with so much fun, we hope.
I want to thank our guest tonight, who has been fantastic in bringing a real enlightening to the world of non-monogamy and seeing how the word consensual is such a key part of that and is part of our lifestyle. The Beast and I talk about this every time, that if we don't have communication and consent, then we're not going to get very far in this lifestyle.
This is so true. Communication, communication, communication. That's my word of the night.
Thank you, Beast. Great words. We'll talk to you next week. And I will hope to have our lovely guest back soon.
Well, thank you. I'd love to come back.
This has been episode 3 of the Kinky Cast. Each week we explore the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Today's guest was Shiva's Vessel on the topic of consensual non-monogamy. Join our hosts Woody and the Beast with co-star Cassie and Max each week. See you next week for even more excitement.